You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
Welcome to the Director Series Podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
He found it in a screenplay by David Koepp called Panic Room, inspired by true stories of small, impenetrable fortresses that New York City's wealthy elite were building for themselves inside their homes. Because the story lent itself so well to an overtly Hitchcockian style of execution and form, Fincher approached his fifth feature as an exercise in pure genre, refusing to elevate the material with the infusion of potent allegory and subtextual thematics like he had done with Fight Club or even Seven.
Hey, what is funny about this? Is this shit funny to you?
I spent the last 12 years of my life building these rooms specifically to keep out people like us.
Oh, it's all so ironic and amusing, okay? Now, how do we get in?
We can't. Can't get in the panic room. That's the whole point. We have to get Howard to come out.
Jodie Foster is compelling as lead heroine Meg Altman, a recently divorced and fiercely maternal woman whose initial mild-manneredness gives way to a resourceful, cunning bravery. Interestingly, Foster replaced original actress Nicole Kidman, who had to leave the production due to the aggravation of an earlier injury. Despite the short notice, Foster exhibited enormous dedication to the role by giving up her chair on the Cannes Film Festival jury, as well as working through the pregnancy of her second child.
You know what could happen if you let yourself get worked up? Sarah!
Kristen Stewart, who was only 11 at the time of filming, turns in a great performance as Sarah, Meg's spunky, rebellious daughter, blessed with an intelligence beyond her years, and the cynicism to match.
Get out of my house!
Say fuck.
Fuck!
Mom, get the fuck out of my house.
Get the fuck out of my house!
Stewart provides a nice balance to Meg's refined femininity with a rough, tomboyish, and androgynous quality, something which Foster had herself at Stewart's age. In making the character of Sarah diabetic, Stewart is able to become an active participant in the suspense and engage us on a personal, visceral level.
Who's that?
This is Raoul.
Who the fuck is Raoul?
The three burglars antagonizing our leads prove just as compelling due to a complex combination of values and virtues that cause conflict between them. The most accessible of the three is Forrest Whitaker as Burnham, a professional builder of panic rooms and a sensitive, honorable man who projects a warm, authoritative presence.
Hey. All I know about this is what I see on TV. You gotta talk me through this.
This complex physicality is essential to the success of the role, and Fincher's choice of Whitaker, who he previously knew not as an actor initially, but as a fellow director of propaganda films, is an inspired one. Burnham is compelled by obligation to his family, not greed, meaning that while he's misguided in his attempts to right his wrongs, he's not beyond saving.
What about us? What if she has a gun? Who are you?
I'm Raoul.
His antithesis is Raoul, a mysterious, volatile man who quickly asserts himself as the group's dangerous wild card. Raoul is played by Dwight Yoakam, a country singer turned actor who injects a great deal of menace to the proceedings.
You fucking bitch! You fucking bitch! I'm coming in there!
Hey, calm the fuck down.
Jared Leto, who previously appeared in Fight Club, benefits from the expanded screen presence that the character of Junior affords him. Junior is the self-designated leader of the operation, but he quickly finds control of the situation slipping from his grasp as the night unfolds.
Quiet.
Leto finds an inspired angle into what would otherwise be the stock, hot-headed, impatient villain archetype by turning Junior into a trust fund kid whose ill-advised attempts at giving himself some edge, like those atrocious dreadlocks for instance, only lead him to being taken even less seriously by the hardened criminals he's trying so hard to impress. Panic Room, like all of Fincher's feature work before Zodiac, was filmed in the Super 35mm film format. While shot open matte in the full-frame Academy aspect ratio, the finished film was presented in the anamorphic aspect ratio, so that Fincher has total freedom to compose the frame as he sees fit. He does it this way, as opposed to natively shooting anamorphic, because he apparently hates limited lens choices and shallow depth of field that plague the process. Fincher hired his 7 cinematographer Darius Kanji to shoot Panic Room, but Kanji left the production 2 weeks into the shoot over his misgivings about Fincher's meticulously planned and extensively pre-visualized approach, which stifled any on-set spontaneity. Cinematography duties were then passed on to Conrad W. Hall, not to be confused with his father, the legendary Conrad Hall, who shot Road to Perdition and Cool Hand Luke. Hall Jr. proves adept at replicating Fincher's signature aesthetic via a high-contrast lighting scheme and a cold color palette whereby traditionally warm incandescent bulbs glow a pale yellow and the harsh fluorescence of the panic room take on a blue-teal cast. Fincher's mise-en-scene is dotted with practical lights, creating an underexposed, moody image that is bolstered by a no-light approach, meaning that Fincher and Hall sought as much darkness as they could get away with, primarily using the extremely soft light afforded by Kinoflow rigs. A highlight of Panic Room's look is a constant, fluid, and precise camera that glides and floats through the house, as if unfettered by the limitations of human operation. This technique is achieved through the combination of a techno crane and CGI that stitches multiple shots into one seamless move. The best example of this is the virtuoso long take that occurs as the burglars break into the house. We first see them arrive and swoop through the house as they try various entry points, all the while taking the time to show us Meg and Sarah asleep and unaware of the impending danger. This shot would have been impossible to achieve before the rise of digital effects, a revolution that Fincher helped usher in due to his familiarity with the process from his days at ILM. Because of his natural grasp on digital filmmaking tech, he is able to turn this incredibly complicated shot into a thesis money shot, condenses his entire visual approach for the film into a single moment, while effortlessly establishing the geography of the house and orienting us for what's to come. In developing Panic Room, he realized he wanted to create the entire house as a singular, contained studio set, so that he could exert complete control, a la Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. Toward that end, he hired 7's production designer, Arthur Max, to construct a fully featured house as one continuous structure inside a large soundstage, with walls and floors that could be flown out to accommodate a camera gliding through the set. Max's work here is nothing less than masterful, as nary a seam of the complicated construction exposes itself throughout the entire film. The same could be said of the fluid edit by editor James Haygood, working in collaboration with Angus Wall. Panic Room is Wall's first feature editing job for Fincher, and his success here has led to continued employment in Fincher's later features. After a brief hiatus during the production of Fight Club, composer Howard Shore returns to Fincher's fold with a brassy, old-school score that oozes intrigue and foreboding. During this time, Shore was consumed with scoring duties for Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings trilogy, so Panic Room was an assignment taken on precisely because of its low musical demands. As it turns out, Shore's work in Panic Room is generally regarded as some of his best and most brooding. The score is complemented by a superb sound mix by Fincher's regular sound designer, Ren Kleiss. When done right, genre is a potent conduit for complex ideas and allegory, with real-world implications. Panic Room is essentially about 2 women fending off 3 male home invaders, but it is also about much more. Their surveillance state, income inequality, the switching of the parent-child dynamic, the list goes on. A visionary director like Fincher is able to take a seemingly generic home invasion thriller and turn it into an evocative exploration of resonant themes and ideas. For instance, Panic Room affords Fincher the opportunity to indulge in his love for architecture, letting him essentially design and build an entire house from scratch. The type of architecture that the house employs is also telling, adopting the handsome wood and crown molding of traditional brownstone houses found on the East Coast. Architecture also serves an important narrative purpose, with the story incorporating building guts like air vents and telephone lines as a dramatic hinging points that obstruct our hero's progress and build suspense. Again, Fincher employs low-angle compositions to reveal the set ceiling in a bid to communicate the location's realness, as well as instill a sense of claustrophobia. Fincher's fascination with tech is woven directly into the storyline, which allows him to explore the dramatic potential of a concrete room with a laser-activated door and surveillance cameras and monitors. The twist, however, is that despite all this cutting-edge technology, well, cutting-edge in 2002, both the protagonist and the antagonist have to resort to lo-fi means to advance their cause. Another aesthetic idea that Fincher had been playing with during this period is the idea of micro-sized objects sized up to a macro scale. Fincher echoes this conceit in Panic Room when he's zooming in on crumbling concrete until it's as big as a mountain, or diving through a gas hose as the burglars pump propane gas into the panic room, or even jumping inside the glass enclosure of a flashlight to see a close-up of the bulb sparking on and off. Fincher ties this visual idea in with another signature of his films, imaginative opening credit sequences. With Panic Room, he places his collaborators' names against the steel and glass canyons of New York City, as if the letters themselves were as big as skyscrapers and had always been a part of their respective structures. Finally, the nihilistic punk flair that hangs over Fincher's filmography has a small presence in Kristen Stewart's androgynous stylings, as well as the appearance of the Sex Pistols' Sid Vicious on one of her t-shirts. Fincher's desire to exert total control of the shoot via meticulous set building and extensive computer pre-visualization ended up working against him, making for a long, strenuous shoot bogged down by technical difficulties and a crawling pace. However, the effort was worth it. Panic Room was a box office hit upon its release, receiving generally positive reviews. As a lean, mean thriller, Panic Room is incredibly exhilarating and well-made. More importantly, Panic Room would be the last feature that Fincher ever shot on celluloid film. The new millennium would bring the swift rise of digital filmmaking, a technology that Fincher, as a noted perfectionist and control freak, would swiftly embrace. Panic Room closes the book on the first phase of Fincher's feature career, a phase marked by gritty, subversive fare shot on film, and heralded the arrival of a new chapter that would solidify Fincher's legacy as one of our best living filmmakers.
Ah, how about this? West 83rd, two-bedroom, doorman building. Park block, partial views, bright and cheery flat. High ceilings and wood floors.
Yeah, that one. I like the sound of that one.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.